Have you ever wondered what would happen if a small-town preacher suddenly felt called to minister to violent gang members in America's most dangerous neighborhoods? The Cross and the Switchblade chronicles precisely this unlikely journey. Published in 1962, this remarkable true story became an international sensation, selling over 15 million copies in over 30 languages. The book inspired a 1970 film starring Pat Boone and launched a global ministry that continues today. Even Billy Graham called it one of the most inspiring and challenging true stories I have ever read. What makes this account so compelling is not just the dramatic transformation of hardened gang members and drug addicts, but the raw vulnerability of David Wilkerson himself, a rural Pentecostal minister who followed an improbable divine calling into the heart of New York's gang territories with nothing but faith and compassion. It all began on a quiet evening in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. David Wilkerson, a 26-year-old Pentecostal minister, sat alone in his study after selling his television set following a spiritual challenge. While attempting to pray, he kept feeling drawn to a Life magazine on his desk. When he finally opened it, he saw a drawing of seven teenage boys on trial for murder in New York City. The eyes of one boy, a member of the notorious Dragons gang who had murdered a 15-year-old polio victim named Michael Farmer, caught his attention with such bewilderment and despair that Wilkerson began to cry unexpectedly. In that moment, he felt a clear divine instruction to go to New York to help these boys. When he shared this strange calling with his congregation, they responded with stoic silence, followed by a silent offering totaling exactly $75, just enough for the trip. His youth director, Miles Hoover, agreed to accompany him, though both harbored doubts about this mission. On the Pennsylvania Turnpike, seeking confirmation, Wilkerson asked Miles to randomly open his Bible and read. The passage he found was Psalm 126, 5-6. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. He that goeth forth and weepeth, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. This encouragement sustained them as they drove toward New York, though neither had any idea what awaited them in the big city. The culture shock was immediate. New York overwhelmed Wilkerson. Endless traffic, confusing highways, the shocking marquees of Times Square advertising naked secrets and teenage girl of the night. Even the $2 overnight parking fee at their modest hotel shocked his small-town sensibilities. From his hotel window, he watched teenagers huddled around a street fire below, reminding him of the gang members whose faces haunted him. After persistent calls, Wilkerson learned that only Judge Davidson could grant permission to see the imprisoned boys, and he'd be at the trial the next morning. After a sleepless night and morning fast, Wilkerson and Miles arrived early at the massive courthouse, joining 40 people waiting for the 42 available spectator seats. When finally admitted after 90 minutes, they were searched for weapons amid rumors that the Dragons had threatened the judge's life. The defendants were not the hardened criminals Wilkerson had imagined, but seven scared, skinny children handcuffed to hulking guards. When his neighbor in the spectator section expressed hatred toward them, Wilkerson replied quietly, "God seems to be the only one who doesn't." As court adjourned after a morning of testimony, Wilkerson made an impulsive decision that would change everything. Clutching his Bible, he rushed forward, calling, "Your Honor!" Judge Davidson turned angrily as guards seized him, hustling him out amid scurrying photographers. In the vestibule, police searched him for weapons, questioned his identity, and ultimately released him with a warning never to return. Outside, reporters surrounded him, one tricking him into holding up his Bible for photos. Humiliated, Wilkerson returned to the car where he broke down crying. As they crossed the George Washington Bridge leaving New York, he wondered how he could face his congregation after such a failure, doubting the divine guidance he thought he'd received. But this apparent disaster would prove to be the catalyst for his entire ministry. When Wilkerson returned to New York a few days later, a group of teenagers recognized him immediately. "Hey, Davey, preacher!" They had seen his photo in the newspapers as the preacher kicked out of the Michael Farmer trial. His confrontation with authorities had earned him immediate credibility. "You're one of us," they explained, since the police disliked both them and Wilkerson. Through these unexpected connections, Wilkerson gained unprecedented access to New York's gang world, embedding himself deeply in a reality far removed from mainstream society. What he discovered was heartbreaking and far more complex than outsiders realized. Unlike the relatively innocent social clubs of his youth, which focused on sports and neighborhood pride, New York had evolved into a landscape dominated by bopping gangs capable of organized warfare, specialty gangs centered around sexual exploitation and deviance, and underground parties featuring increasingly disturbing activities that often ended in violence. The drug trade emerged as the most insidious force destroying young lives. Marijuana dealers operated with shocking boldness, setting up operations near schools and playgrounds, deliberately targeting vulnerable youth. These dealers served as sophisticated recruiters for harder drugs, particularly heroin, understanding that marijuana often served as a gateway to more profitable addictions. Their tactics were calculated and cruel, offering free samples, orchestrating peer pressure campaigns, and exploiting adolescent insecurities. Wilkerson witnessed numerous devastating scenes of addiction's grip. In one particularly haunting incident, he observed a young man experiencing severe withdrawal, writhing and screaming in agony on a tenement floor while neighbors walked past his door numb to such suffering. When questioned, they explained with resigned fatalism that hospitals routinely turned away addicts seeking help, lacking both space and resources for treatment. The medical system's failure to address addiction as a health crisis only deepened the community's despair. The economics of the heroin trade revealed its ruthless efficiency. A single kilogram of heroin, purchased in Beirut for approximately $3,000, could generate up to $300,000 on New York streets under normal conditions. During strategic supply shortages, orchestrated by dealers to drive up prices, that same kilo could yield up to $1 million. The city's vast transportation network, with its 12,500 ships and 18,000 annual airplane arrivals, overwhelmed the mere 265 customs agents tasked with interdiction, making large-scale smuggling virtually inevitable. The financial demands of addiction trapped teenagers in an escalating cycle of crime and dealing. Requiring $25 to $60 daily just to avoid withdrawal, young addicts quickly exhausted their limited resources. With only lunch money and occasional odd jobs available, they faced a brutal choice: engage in theft, prostitution, or become dealers themselves. This created an exponential growth in addiction, as each new dealer needed to recruit additional users to support their habit. The mathematics were stark. To support a $25 daily habit, they needed to steal $75 worth of goods, contributing to an estimated $200 million in annual thefts across the city. Wilkerson gradually recognized a tragic pattern in these young lives, beginning with profound emotional and social isolation, progressing through gang membership for protection and belonging, then descending through escalating violence, sexual exploitation, and drug addiction toward premature death. Their dreams and aspirations were heartbreakingly modest. Some longed simply for a fashionable hat while lacking a winter coat, while others dreamed of crossing the Brooklyn Bridge into Manhattan, a journey many never attempted, confined to their neighborhoods by invisible boundaries of gang territories and fear. After months of methodically exploring New York's most dangerous streets and housing projects, David Wilkerson decided to put his faith-driven vision to the ultimate test. He believed even the most hardened teen gang members could experience radical spiritual transformation. His target? Fort Greene Projects in Brooklyn, a sprawling complex of brick high-rises housing over 30,000 residents, predominantly Negro and Puerto Rican families living in challenging conditions. The projects were terrorized by two infamous gangs, the Negro Chaplains and the Spanish Mau Maus, whose recent declaration of war against police had escalated to dropping heavy sandbags from rooftops onto patrol cars attempting to kill officers. Accompanied by Jimmy, a talented trumpet player who shared his mission, Wilkerson arrived before dawn one Friday morning. Their first attempt to draw attention by playing Onward Christian Soldiers quickly attracted police, who ordered them to leave, viewing them as potential troublemakers. Undeterred, they returned with simple props, an American flag and a wooden piano stool to serve as a makeshift pulpit. As a hostile crowd gathered, hurling insults and mockery, Wilkerson felt overwhelmed by their hostility. Standing on the stool, he prayed desperately for divine intervention, knowing his human efforts alone would fail. What happened next defied explanation. An eerie silence suddenly descended over the previously jeering crowd. Taking advantage of this unexpected moment, Wilkerson passionately shared John 3:16, emphasizing that God loved them exactly as they were, their tattoos, their violence, their struggles, and all, but also saw their potential for transformation. When his invitation for response was met with stony silence, he made an impromptu challenge that would become legendary in street ministry. If you are so big and tough, you won't mind shaking hands with a skinny preacher. To everyone's amazement, including his own, Buckboard, the imposing president of the Chaplains, stepped forward. He was followed by Stagecoach, his vice president, and two intimidating warlords. Their response sent shockwaves through the crowd and demonstrated the first crack in the gang's hardened exterior. The reaction from the Mau Mau leadership proved more complex. Israel, one of their leaders, showed cautious respect, shaking Wilkerson's hand with reserved politeness. But it was Nicky Cruz, whose face reflected years of violence and hatred, who made the most memorable impression. With cold eyes that seemed to bore through Wilkerson, Nicky issued a chilling threat. "You come near me, preacher, and I'll kill you." This confrontation, though frightening, would later prove providential. Both Nicky and Israel would eventually undergo transformations so dramatic they would become powerful testimonies to the possibility of change in even the most hardened gang members, helping establish the foundation for Wilkerson's expanding ministry to troubled youth. After months of street ministry, Wilkerson received a clear vision for what was needed. A welcoming house with many beds, clothes, and a big kitchen where troubled youth could truly belong. This seemed impossible, requiring miracles he'd never witnessed, yet the vision persisted. The opportunity came when Spanish churches in New York invited Wilkerson to organize a mass rally for teenagers at St. Nicholas Arena. The churches provided street workers, counselors, and handled logistics. Wilkerson's only job was to bring the teenagers, a task that seemed simple at first, but grew more daunting as the date approached. The first four nights were utterly discouraging. Instead of swarms of enthusiastic youth, only about 100 people showed up in an arena that held 7,000. The teenagers who did come treated it like entertainment, blowing smoke rings and making lewd remarks. The turning point came through an unexpected encounter with Little Jojo, president of the Coney Island Dragons. After Jojo pointed out the contrast between them, "Look, rich man, it's all right for you to come here and talk big about God changing lives. You've got new shoes and a suit that match. Look at me, I'm a bum." Wilkerson impulsively took off his shoes and insisted Jojo try them on. This simple act of sacrificial love broke through Jojo's defenses. That night, Jojo prayed his first sincere prayer, asking God to give Wilkerson a boy, since he already had two girls. When news came that Wilkerson's wife had delivered a 10-pound son, Jojo was amazed. "What do you know about that?" That night, Jojo was transformed, crying out all his bitterness, hatred, doubts, and fears. The final night of the rally brought another breakthrough. When Wilkerson asked for 6 volunteers from the gangs to take up the collection, Nicky, the same boy who had threatened to kill him, stepped forward with 5 other Mau Maus. The crowd watched breathlessly, expecting the boys to steal the money and flee. Minutes passed, turning to howls of derision at Wilkerson's apparent naivety. Then, suddenly, the room froze. Nicky and his boys were crossing the stage with the full collection cartons. Despite this breakthrough, Wilkerson's sermon fell flat until he surrendered the meeting to the Holy Spirit. After 3 minutes of silent prayer, the rowdy arena fell completely silent. Then Israel began crying, followed by Nicky. When Wilkerson invited those wanting transformation to come forward, Israel commanded his gang, "Boys, I've been your leader for 3 years. When I say go, you go, right?" They raced forward, with Nicky among them. After these dramatic conversions in the streets of New York, David Wilkerson felt an unmistakable divine calling to establish a permanent presence in the city. In December 1960, during a time of intense prayer, he received a clear spiritual impression to investigate Clinton Avenue in Brooklyn. There, he and his committee discovered a once magnificent $65,000 Georgian mansion that had fallen into severe disrepair. The property had been abandoned for 2 years, save for an elderly squatter who had transformed the grand residence into a makeshift warehouse for collected refuse. The mansion, despite its deteriorated state with broken water pipes, crumbling plaster walls, and splintered doors, still emanated an air of former glory. The committee could envision its potential as a beacon of hope in the neighborhood. Through persistent negotiations with the property owners, who recognized the charitable nature of the project, the asking price dropped significantly to $42,000. Still wrestling with the decision, Wilkerson sought divine confirmation. During a routine Sunday service at Glad Tidings Church, without any mention of the specific need or direct fundraising appeal, the spontaneous offering reached exactly $4,400, precisely $200 more than initially required, which perfectly covered unexpected legal fees that emerged later. The remaining $8,000 needed for the down payment materialized through equally remarkable circumstances. A congregation in Bethpage, moved by the vision for troubled youth, contributed $3,000. The remainder came through an unexpected blank check from Arthur Graves' church, demonstrating the project's growing support across denominational lines. Within just 1 month of taking this step of faith, God had orchestrated the provision of exactly $12,200, down to the last cent. The initial cleanup effort revealed the truly overwhelming scope of the accumulation. Hidden rooms emerged as volunteers cleared through mountains of newspapers, broken furniture, and assorted debris that reached from floor to ceiling. Young volunteers, many from local churches, worked tirelessly day after day, systematically clearing pathways through the chaos. The project required 6 industrial-sized garbage trucks to completely remove the accumulated waste, transforming the mansion room by room, floor by floor. The renovated center was meticulously designed with a specific mission in mind: to house 20 dedicated workers who would devote their mornings to prayer and biblical study, then spend afternoons and evenings in strategic street outreach. These teams would work in pairs, identifying troubled teenagers and connecting them with local ministers and resources. The facility was structured to provide emergency housing for the most critical cases, with a carefully planned layout featuring a boys' dormitory on the top floor and girls' accommodations on the second floor. While finding 20 committed individuals willing to risk their safety for a mere $10 weekly stipend seemed like an insurmountable challenge, Wilkerson's presentation at Central Bible College in Missouri resulted in an overwhelming response. 70 students eagerly volunteered, many willing to defer promising careers to serve in this urban ministry. The most challenging cases at Teen Challenge were drug addicts. The narcotics problem in New York was staggering, with official estimates showing over 30,000 addicts in the city, including at least 4,000 teenagers. Most alarming was the increasing percentage of teenage addicts, with some as young as 13 becoming regular users. Police reports indicated that drug-related crimes had increased by 40% in just 2 years, particularly in areas like Brooklyn and the Lower East Side. Traditional withdrawal was excruciating: sweating, chills, fever, vomiting, hallucinations, and nerve pain lasting 3 full days. Even with professional help and medical supervision in the best facilities, 85 to 90% eventually returned to drugs. The physical deterioration was horrific. Rotting teeth, inflamed organs, collapsed veins, skin abscesses, mental deterioration, and early death. Many addicts suffered from hepatitis, malnutrition, and severe respiratory problems. The average life expectancy for a heavy heroin user was just 28 years. After several discouraging failures with addicts who relapsed despite careful support through withdrawal, Wilkerson interviewed dozens of boys who had successfully overcome addiction. A clear pattern emerged. They all mentioned the baptism of the Holy Spirit as the turning point when they gained complete victory over their addictions. This wasn't just temporary relief. These were permanent transformations that defied medical explanation. This spiritual experience, rooted in the biblical account of Pentecost, seemed to provide what medical treatment could not, a power stronger than addiction itself. Lewis, a marijuana user who had tried multiple rehabilitation programs without success, was completely freed from his mind addiction after receiving the baptism. Roberto, who had been addicted to heroin for 8 years, experienced immediate freedom. Harvey, Johnny, Lefty, Vincent, Ruben, and Eddie, with addictions ranging from 2 to 15 years, all experienced similar transformations after their baptisms. Many reported that not only did their physical cravings disappear, but their entire worldview and personality were transformed. Even when relapses occurred, something unexpected happened. Ralph, who had been clean for over a year before relapsing, found that heroin didn't affect him as before. Instead of experiencing the usual euphoria, he felt physically ill and spiritually convicted. He felt compelled to pray and experienced forgiveness rather than disgust. "I think I'm trapped," Ralph told Wilkerson, "but not by heroin. I'm trapped by the Holy Spirit." This phenomenon was observed repeatedly. Former addicts who relapsed reported that drugs no longer provided the escape or pleasure they once did, often describing it as if their bodies had been rewired through their spiritual experience. The success rate at Teen Challenge far exceeded traditional rehabilitation programs, with over 70% of graduates remaining drug-free after 5 years. This caught the attention of medical professionals and addiction specialists who began studying the program's unique approach to recovery through spiritual transformation. By the end of its first summer, Teen Challenge had helped 2,500 young people turn their lives over to Christ, far exceeding anyone's expectations for the fledgling Nestry. The organization faced constant financial challenges, operating on a modest $50,000 annual budget, but often with mere dollars in the bank. Yet time after time, miraculous provision arrived just when needed. One particularly dramatic instance was a $15,000 check that arrived on the very day it was needed to save the center from foreclosure. Similar stories of last-minute provision became commonplace, from anonymous donations appearing in the mail to local businesses offering crucial supplies exactly when they were most needed. From its humble beginning in Brooklyn, Teen Challenge rapidly spread to other major urban centers. Chicago's branch opened in 1963, followed by Philadelphia, Boston, Los Angeles, and Toronto throughout the 1960s. Each new location adapted the core program to meet local needs while maintaining the fundamental spiritual principles that made the Brooklyn Center successful. Today, Teen Challenge operates over 1,400 centers in 129 countries, making it one of the world's largest and most successful drug rehabilitation programs. Studies consistently show success rates of 70 to 86% for Teen Challenge graduates remaining drug-free, compared to 15 to 25% for traditional treatment methods. The guiding principle remains constant: the Holy Spirit is in charge. When the program relies on His power, it thrives. When it depends on human effort alone, it fails. This truth is demonstrated daily across Teen Challenge centers worldwide, where staff members witness remarkable transformations. Former gang members become counselors, addicts become ministers, and broken families find restoration. The program's success lies not in sophisticated treatment protocols, but in its simple focus on spiritual transformation and personal discipleship. What began as a humiliating courtroom fiasco became the catalyst for a global movement that continues to demonstrate that no person is beyond redemption. The ministry has expanded beyond drug addiction to address various forms of life-controlling issues, including alcoholism, gambling, and other destructive behaviors. Teen Challenge's influence extends into prisons, schools, and communities worldwide, offering hope through faith-based recovery programs, prevention education, and outreach services. The organization's success has drawn attention from government agencies, academic researchers, and other rehabilitation programs seeking to understand and replicate its remarkable outcomes. This enduring legacy proves that faith can indeed transform the most desperate situations when combined with compassion, perseverance, and the courage to step into unfamiliar territory. The ministry continues to evolve and adapt to changing needs while maintaining its core principle that love, powered by divine guidance, remains more powerful than hate, addiction, or despair. Each year, thousands of new stories of transformation add to this legacy, confirming the validity of David Wilkerson's original vision and the timeless effectiveness of faith-based intervention in human crisis.